Hi, and welcome back to this episode 5 of season 2 of Indefensible New Zealand. I'm Simon Ewing-Jarvey. I'll just begin today by sending out our collective thoughts and love to the people that are affected by the terrible news of a fire in the housing area at Burnham Military Camp yesterday. I can only imagine how terrible that is for everyone involved. This episode is being done in the lead up to the 2024 budget, which will take place in a couple of weeks in May in New Zealand. And there's many people commenting or speculating that there's going to be an increase, or a substantial increase in the spending for defence and foreign affairs. Well, that remains to be seen. But what is important is to ask the question, well, if there is more spending, then what should it be on? A lot of discussion takes place about what sort of hardware and how many people the New Zealand Defence Force should have in order to achieve its mission. Considerably less discussion takes place around what the government and the people of New Zealand should be doing for the NZDF to be able to achieve its mission. And I want to explore that today in this episode on national power, and particularly on optimum national power and ways we could move towards that. So what is national power and how do we optimise it? In the book Creating Military Power, it's Brooks and Stanley from 2007, they've talked about a wide-ranging number of factors, not just the traditional strategic, operational and tactical plays, and not just the amount of people, the population base, the productivity measures that you might wrap around that, and the national resources that a country might have. And they've talked far more widely, or the contributors to their book have talked far more widely about national power, including things like the culture of a nation, the social structures, and the political institutions which drive it. And I think that's a very relevant set of measures to actually talk about in relation to New Zealand, because if we just keep doing the same old, we'll get pretty much the same result. And I've put the problem, I've put the challenge to many groups of pretty smart people around the defence scene about, okay, just imagine you got given another $2 or $3 billion a year. What would you buy? And invariably, they come up stumped and realise that actually it's not very much money. And how much is enough? No one can really work that out. So let's talk about national power for New Zealand rather than platforms and people for the Defence Force. Now, tactical effectiveness is bringing together all the platforms and the training and the people into developing a capability which enables battles to be fought and won. And that is the New Zealand Defence Force's primary function. But that can't be done without several other elements, and particularly at the political level and the policy level, so government. These settings need to be right in order for the tactical success to take place. And I think it's fair to say that this has been a yawning gap in the way the approach to facilitating NZDF functions has occurred over many, many decades. What we have seen through successive governments, and I'm talking about probably going back to the early 80s, is a satisficing model. And those of you that have done any economics will know what that is. Basically means, in political terms, what's the least we can get away with and still do the bare minimum or the bare credible minimum, that if we don't do that, something, the wheels will fall off something, or someone will notice. And that's simply not good enough when you're talking about national security, and it's certainly not a pathway to developing national power. Our last year's announcement of a defence policy and strategy statement was a lot of policy and not very much strategy. In fact, I don't think it's a strategy at all, and I've commented on that in a previous podcast. It's a lot of words. They bring together a lot of previously held ideas and written things that have been written about, but if you had to say what that is, it's a meta policy. It's a policy that sort of wraps around and sits over the top of 10 or so other existing policies that various governments have established. A strategy, it is not. And I'm looking forward to, well, I'm hoping that this government will take the opportunity soon to develop an actual strategy that is something that can be executed. Now let's face it, strategy, writing a strategy doesn't actually cost very much. There's a few people's salaries that you're probably already paying anyway. strategy only costs in the execution. And if we are fixated on the cost of buying platforms and developing tactical capabilities, we're not actually executing a strategy at all. So success for New Zealand really requires us to focus on or bring together a whole lot of threads. So it's people, ideas, industry, economics, alliances, all sorts of factors that need to be well thought through and well integrated in order for the government to be able to execute a national strategy for developing national power and for national security. Now, I'm not suggesting that we put our economy on a war footing, but I am suggesting that we should move it closer to that. And if we're not going to do that, if we're not prepared to do that at all, then basically we're saying we don't believe all the reports that are coming in of a rapidly deteriorating security situation. Well, you would have to be hiding under a rock and completely disconnected from all news sources to think the world is at peace and that the situation worldwide, not just in our region, is deteriorating. To think we should wait 5 years, 10 years for a normal acquisition process to slowly build up the economy just to have a change of government and go back to another review is madness. New Zealand does not have the national power now. It does not have the national resilience and it does not have the information it needs, the productivity it needs, or the people it needs to contribute effectively to its own defence. Now, I know knockers in this discussion often say, oh, well, who's going to invade New Zealand? Well, no one needs to. Go back to season one if you want to listen to some of the ideas that I put out there about what can happen without any alien boots on the ground. Well, I don't mean ET kind of aliens, you know what I mean. I'm not saying we should be completely self-sufficient. That would be madness. While we can trade in the world and buy things we need at good prices and we can sell things that we produce at good prices, we should. But when those circumstances change, we should be able to be self-reliant in things that are absolutely vital. And you know as well as I do what those vital elements are, the things that arrive just in time on ships to keep the country running, the fuel, the oil, the lubricants, the chemicals, and so on. As I said earlier, our traditional views of national power are focused on population size, wealth of resources, productivity, the industrial base, and so on and so on. But these measures are not the factors that are contributing to significant levels of national power and quite good national security in many, many countries in the world. And I think about the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the Scandinavian countries, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and so on, and Israel. Now, these are all countries that have very, very small populations. They don't have tremendous natural resources. Some have almost none. And many are surrounded or bordered by enemies, people who are quite happy to disregard the rules-based order like Putin and Russia, and like some of the Middle Eastern countries that are currently engaged in conflict. So what is different about those countries? We often look at them and compare ourselves to them on all sorts of measures. Well, why not in terms of the way they develop national power? Well, what is different, as was mooted in the book I mentioned earlier, is their culture, their societal structures, their political institutions are geared towards developing national power. They've had problems before. They know they'll have them again. And in this, they've learned. One common thread that goes through all those countries is they have some form of national service. Conscription, balloting, call it what you will. But instead of being the negative that it's often been seen in countries like ours, it's actually seen as a positive. In many countries, it's highly competitive. The people who go through the National Service Program have all sorts of benefits. They develop networks that sustain their careers for their entire lives. I'm not suggesting New Zealand needs conscription, but I am suggesting that New Zealand needs voluntary national service now. Now, I've written and spoken about VNS a lot. It's a policy that I refer to as a coordinated self-interest. So the country needs something, the individuals need something, and you find a way to work through that. So voluntary national service, for instance, for young New Zealanders might not see them necessarily serving in the Army, Navy, or Air Force. It might see them in the police, fire, ambulance, medical system, all sorts of ways that you can serve your country. The civil defence and emergency management, as occurs in many countries like Singapore. And what do they get out of it? Well, they get fantastic training, and they get tertiary loans. They get tertiary education for free, or their loans remitted as part of their service remuneration. There's a multitude of ways that voluntary national service can be implemented that is highly sought after by individuals. And I'm not saying vast numbers, because realistically, New Zealand doesn't have the capacity to take in, you know, say 50 or 60,000 eligible 19-year-olds each year, and a whole lot of them, you know, wouldn't be able to walk off the bus to the showers without, you know, having a medical event. So if everyone is eligible and the standards are set at a certain level, I'm confident that we could actually have a reasonable inflow of people. Now, that does give us a larger defence force, that's true. But equally as important is it shapes the culture of society. It builds military capability, and it creates a more resilient society at the same time. And if people don't believe that, then they don't believe in any of the other social interventions that are being proposed at the moment, like boot camps, limited service volunteer schemes, and so on and so forth. Another key element of generating optimum national power is the way that we take care of people who have served or are serving now, because that's the window into the system that people who are not involved measures how seriously the country takes service and how well they can expect to be cared for, or for their family members can be expected to be cared for if they are to serve the country in some form. So in terms of former servicemen and women, I'm avoiding the term veterans because I know it's a loaded term, but anyone that has got a service number that shows they have put on a uniform, we have to do a whole lot better. And it's not just a matter of doing the right thing by them by creating and observing a service covenant between the government and the people and those that served. It's actually about providing an example of how desirable it is, or how well you'll be taken care of should you serve the country. And that's an important part of national power. So what about money? Because all this does cost. New Zealand has to stop choosing to be poor. And by that, I mean we get really, really busily engaged in a whole lot of really low-value activities like tourism, for instance. There's people making money out of tourism, but there's a whole lot of people working for minimum wage or not much above it just to keep that whole system running. And you only have to look at when the lockdowns happened to see how vulnerable industries like that are. So in governmental terms, there's a big role for a targeted research and development here to generate ideas, innovation, and position New Zealand as a leader in technological innovation. You go anywhere in the world where something pretty cool is happening, some new innovation, there'll be Kiwis involved, but they're not here and they're not doing it for us by and large. We're not the place where many New Zealanders choose to create their innovation. So where else can the money come from? During the war, the government issued bonds, Liberty bonds, bomber bonds, you know, war bonds, basically. So it's a government bond which has a rate of return. And that was a way of getting private money into the system to be able to build up the defence force and conduct the war. Now, I ask you, if you're a person that actually is keen on having a stronger defence force and you've got a few bucks in your pocket that you're looking to invest, you can stick it into KiwiSaver, you can go into a managed fund, you can buy shares, you've got a whole lot of options. Would you consider buying a defence bond, a national security bond? Because I would. And if you were to issue it as a government, would it be just the same value as any other Treasury bond that's issued, the Kiwi bonds, brackets, defence, or would you incentivise it to try and draw money into that scheme? And it's something that I hope this government, which has been talking about social bonds, extend its thinking into defence bonds. Now, our defence industry here in New Zealand has a role to play in this, and you can go to Defence Industry Association of New Zealand, dianz.co.nz, and have a look at them. The defence industry in New Zealand really falls into two big chunks. There's the big international players like Lockheed Martin, who have got an office here. Then there are multiple defence industries, or members of the defence industry, that do all sorts of things. And this is to be encouraged. It's great. Some of them are not just doing work for defence, they're doing dual purpose work. And I think that's an essential element of how we create and sustain a defence industry here in New Zealand. So we should be looking to maximise this area through the use of and encouragement of dual-use technologies. For instance, the company that's making computer games can also make weapons effects simulators, flight simulators, ships, bridge simulators, and so on and so forth. Drones are a classic example of a multi-use technology, and we can go on and on about this, but the thing is, these companies, in many cases, are world leaders or have the potential to be, and they may not even be considering the defence space because it's simply too hard to engage, and we need to change that in our governmental settings to encourage the maximum development of national security capability products and services here. There are some industries relating to defence that have never existed here, or they haven't been here for a very, very long time. And if you look at the trends around the world, area denial is one that all the big players are involved in, whether it's trying to stop what's perceived as aggressive elements moving down into this area, or whether it is those countries that are not so happy with us trying to push us out of areas or keep us out of areas. Area denial is currently driving a lot of thinking, and otherwise why would you have nuclear submarines and the like? The New Zealand just can't afford to continue to rely on just-in-time ship arrivals for the things that we need to run the country. Most people don't realise just how quickly this country would grind to a halt if fuels, oils and lubricants stopped coming here. And having our fuel reserve held in Japan on paper is not really that useful if no one can sail a ship here. It's not just fuel, oil, lubricants. It's chemicals, it's microchips, it's ammunition and missiles. This too, I think, has to be a priority for the government. Developing some type of policy which will build resilience when the ships stop coming, because there is going to be a day when they stop coming. And we only got a small taste of that during COVID, where we're at the end of a long shipping trail and it just became too hard to meet protocols, so the ships, some of them just stopped coming here. Now, in my consulting work, I do a lot of work with business continuity planning and management, and many of the organisations that ask me to help them are looking for a way of testing their policies and procedures. So we design and we conduct essentially business war games, so business simulations that create a dilemma for either the board of directors or the leadership team or both. Because let's face it, a plan that hasn't been tested is not that useful. You really have to test plans regularly to ensure people are familiar with them and to find out what will happen, where the fish hooks are in them. These simulations that we run cover everything from cyber attack and ransomware to loss and denial of facilities and services, loss of key personnel, reputational risk, psychopathological behaviour, and much, much more. Basically, whatever the organisation wants to assess. And there are no notice activities. One person, normally the chief executive, will know when, but no one will know exactly what the nature of the simulation is going to be. I was inspired recently by a talk, I think it was Wayne Smith, about his time coaching rugby, and he was asked about the difference between coaching the women's code and the men's code, and he said something to the effect of, men need to win to feel good. Women, by and large, need to feel good in order to win. And that's quite profound. With the organisations I challenge with business continuity simulations, they usually start off quite nervous. They eventually find their feet, read their plan, break up the piece of work, usually a bit of coaching and mentoring to move them through it, and they get to a reasonable outcome at the end and feel pretty good about it. The realisation that they didn't get everything right, but they would have actually handled the situation had it been real, means it's a win and they feel good. So I'd say that organisational leadership teams are much more like women's sports teams when it comes to feeling good in order to win rather than the other way around, because you aren't always going to win. And the real test of leadership is when you're leading a team that's continually losing. And it might be tough on the rugby field, but it's lethal on the battlefield. I have to say, mostly though, the organisations that we're doing this kind of work with are the minority. The vast majority of people, the vast majority of organisations are much like the vast majority of people, that they're kind of not too worried about some event happening. Auckland will say, well, we're not earthquake prone, so your messaging about earthquake is not really right. And I think it's fair to say that the vast majority have no up-to-date policies and procedures in order to build resilience. They've got what they have to have, which is a fire escape plan and health and safety and emergency plan for this and that, and they've got coloured jackets that people can put on to count heads when they move outside. But that is not resilience, that's not preparedness. And we really, as a country, have to do much better, because if we can't even get our organisations to this position in terms of highly likely events, what chance have we got of building resilience for war? So let's talk about the New Zealand people. Is the public at large up for a war? No. There's a diminishing number of people who have any direct memory of the visceral nature of war, of having a parent or having gone themselves, or having a parent, family member go to war and hopefully come back, or having a neighbour that was sitting on the porch, shell-shocked, PTSD, maybe missing a limb. I had a teacher in primary school who was missing an arm and had shrapnel burns all over his face. Now that can't help but have an effect on people understanding the true nature of war and the need to prepare to try and minimise that harm. But the growing number of children and young people who go to Anzac Day services do not have that visceral connection. They have a, at best, a Hollywood connection and granddad's medals. And I'm not saying we should be scaring people into a state of preparing for war. I'm saying we should be realistic about the fact we're not prepared, and there are things that we can do to be better at that. We'll never be great at it, but we can be better at it. If we're to have a resilient country, then basically the people need to be inoculated. They need to be introduced to the realities of why things need to be done. And at the moment, if you look at the surveying that the Civil Defence National Emergency Management Agency are doing, a few of them, 20% of people, say that they're fully prepared to deal with an emergency in terms of the water and food they've got and other bits and pieces, medicine to see them through a shortage. Fewer than 20%. And it's much the same as the data I find with businesses and other organisations as well. And the situation's even more dire when you think that that is event-based thinking by and large. Like, people get very prepared for the last thing that happened. If someone's house gets burgled, they tend to think about their alarm system and the insurance, their security systems. So if you experience an earthquake and a few things fell off the wall, then probably those people will start thinking about some more earthquake resilience. But I want to encourage people to think about effects, not events. And this is exactly where NEMA is taking its education program as well. Let's talk about the sort of effects that would concern every single New Zealander. No power. Now, whether the power is out because there was an earthquake and that destroyed a power station, or whether it's because someone threw a cruise missile 1,000 kilometres away and it landed in the power station, it actually doesn't matter. You and your family, your kids, you're all without power. So you're prepared for it. How about no internet or cellular system? Once again, it could just be a natural outage, a breakdown, but it also could be that an aggressor state has severed undersea cables, of which we're highly vulnerable, or there's been an electromagnetic attack in space, or some form of space attack which has taken out satellites. How would a system which is so geared to operating online operate in New Zealand, and how would you cope? Contaminated drinking water. Now, it might just be that we've got the Havelock North problem and there's stock nearby, or there's been flooding and the water's contaminated, and so you're on a boil water notice, or you've got to carry a 20-litre jerry cans down the street to go and get them from a pickup point. Or it could be that a fifth columnist in a situation has put some toxin in the water supply. What about hospitals overflowing or no pharmaceuticals available in the country because the ships just didn't come? Not enough planes came. What about no petrol or diesel? We're highly vulnerable to the last tanker that arrived. Now, I'm not suggesting the entire country should become an episode of doomsday preppers, but I hope I've made the point that effects felt in natural disaster here in New Zealand are actually the same effects that you find if you have a war in the region. Area denial strategies, something short of war, but people make it difficult to move around. And we're not ready for that either. So I think that's probably enough. In terms of national power, there's a lot of work to do. And there's things that the government needs to do in terms of its policies about developing national power, about getting the right agencies. And we need that National Intelligence and Security Agency that was recommended a couple of years ago that needs to be stood up. We need to encourage research and development in the right areas. We need to encourage the defence industry generally, and particularly anything that we can build dual-use technologies out of. Organisations need to think about their business continuity and crisis plans, because we need you running to keep the economy running. And every single person needs to think about what it is that they can do, from perhaps volunteering in a voluntary national service setting, to just making sure that you can cope with effects-based problems like lack of power, water, pharmaceuticals, and so on. So that's it for now. I didn't mean that to be doomy and gloomy, but I realise it might be sounding a little bit that way. Something a bit more upbeat next time. So if you've got any questions for this podcast, just send them to me. Go to unclaz.com and just go to the contacts page, and I'll do my best to answer your questions from there. In the meantime, be careful out there and go check your emergency water supply. That's it. See ya.